I'm Taryn Ward, and this is Breaking the Feed, Social Media Beyond the Headlines. We're taking a closer look at the core issues around social media, including the freedom of expression or free speech, to better understand the role social media plays in our everyday lives and society. Last episode, we discussed the Western framework for protecting the freedom of expression, and whether in its existing form, it's up to the task of grappling with some of the big issues we're facing in an era of life online and artificial intelligence. We've spent quite a lot of time covering some basic concepts and looking at how the system works as a whole and how various pieces fit together. We tried to keep it interesting where we could, but we felt it was important to set things out before doing some deeper dives on the issues we're currently facing. This episode will take the first step towards a deep dive on hate speech. This is probably a good time to flag that some of the episodes in our hate speech series are rated 18+. We have some big and difficult issues to tackle, and it's impossible to talk around some of the very adult themes that come up when we look at hate speech. So for this limited part of our series, we've rated the episodes accordingly. Hate speech is one of those topics that comes up every few years, gains a lot of attention, so there's a lot of discussion, and then sort of disappears again. We think it's likely to come up quite a bit this year and is worth a closer look. Hate speech is unique in some ways because there are such different approaches even within the West. This isn't a case of the EU doing things one way and China another. The United States and Europe have very different approaches even between them. And unlike many other areas of the law, these differences are neither surface level nor the kinds of differences that tend to result in the same outcomes anyway. In the United States, the First Amendment jurisprudence classifies hate speech as protected speech, fully protected speech. So in other words, unless the speech at issue triggers one of the other exceptions, hate speech enjoys the full protection of the First Amendment. The European Convention on Human Rights takes a very different approach and balances hate speech or the hate speech restriction at issue against any other rights that could be at issue. So hate speech is not considered fully protected in the same way it is in the United States. Why the difference? Well, there are a number of potential reasons, but a few that are fairly well known and widely discussed and that I find plausible center around the differences between the two legal systems as a whole, including their histories, cultural differences more broadly, and a different emphasis on the fundamental justifications for the freedom to begin with. If you believe freedom of expression is exclusively or primarily based on its necessity to discover the truth, for example, you might have a different position on hate speech than if you believe it's necessary for the existence of democracy, which may be different still than if you believe it's about individual self-fulfillment or realization. Now again, we can debate what these different approaches mean for hate speech and whether one is more justified than the other, but it's important to remember that each country has one or more traditions and often legal precedents that ground them, so it's not necessarily a quick or easy change and not even necessarily a desirable one. To further complicate things, international treaties don't always agree. So you have the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They all treat freedom of expression as non-absolute, especially where it undermines the right to equality and non-discrimination. But these treaties don't all provide for the same approaches to which types of hate speech should or must be restricted. And in some ways, the standards contradict each other. And that's all before you get to regional treaties, like the American Convention on Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, and the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, which don't always align with each other or the relevant international treaties. Not that there are necessarily huge, huge differences, but small differences can mean different outcomes that can look very strange and feel contradictory. Then, of course, you have countries that sign treaties with reservations or sign some but not others. And then you have to figure out how those countries are going to interpret them and what those obligations mean for them internally. And that's before we even look at differences on the national level. So it really is a complicated web to sort out. And some of this should be complicated. So this is a really important issue, and there's no one way or one right way to grapple with it. But I think it's important to be clear here that the United States is very much an outlier, and it is in large part the source of that complexity. You may think that's a good thing, you may think that's a bad thing, but it really does stand alone in this area of the law in many important ways. So the United States has held a firm line, consistently asserting that this type of speech, hate speech, can only be restricted if it is directed at inciting or producing imminent lawless action, or is likely to incite or produce such action, or falls under one or the other clearly identified and very narrow exceptions. I was having a conversation with a friend over coffee the other day, and I really want to emphasize again how narrow these exceptions are, because I think sometimes we hear oh, there are exceptions, you know, incitement, that can mean a lot of different things. And in Europe, it really can. But in the United States, it's a very narrow thing. One of the things that came out of discussions around the recent House committee hearing on anti-Semitism on university campuses is a profound discomfort with context in this area of the law. But whether you prefer the European approach, which balances the right to speech or expression against other rights, like the right to equality and non-discrimination, or the traditional U.S. approach, context plays a central role in determining whether speech is classified as hate speech, how it must, should, or can be regulated, and ultimately whether it's punishable. And I should say that many Americans find the outcome of European cases surprising and difficult and deeply uncomfortable. So it is just worth noting that these are different approaches, and we'll get into that much more over the next couple of episodes. When we hear really extreme hate speech, we're very often horrified or even shocked by it. And I think sometimes our human instinctual response is kill it with fire, make it go away, just, you know, get rid of it. And I think that's really understandable because this speech is really troubling and it hits something inside of us, especially if it's something we can relate to. But sometimes hard cases do make bad law. And so what you end up with is a very specific fact pattern that makes us uncomfortable, resulting in a rule that, when applied more broadly, is really damaging to a fundamental right like free expression. Because we can't just restrict the speech we don't like and permit the speech we do like. That doesn't fit within any of the philosophical justifications for protecting that freedom, and it takes us down a sort of, you know, winding, dark path. For example, it's been really interesting to see some so-called free speech absolutists be so vocal about the protests on university campuses and the alleged failure of universities to appropriately restrict this speech. When pushed, many of these advocates say what really bothers them is a perceived double standard. In their eyes, universities allow anti-Semitic comments in protests as protected speech, but consider comments on sex as a biological reality or refusal to recognize someone's pronouns or a KKK rally as unprotected. But this is where the argument can start to go off the rails, because it's changing the core question to whether a rule is fairly or equitably applied, rather than addressing the rule itself and considering whether that rule is correct. To put it another way, whether the rules are being applied fairly is a separate question to whether the rule itself is working. Now, we can be concerned about both, of course, and that's often the case, but they do deserve to be analyzed separately so that we can figure out where our concern really is and whether we need to throw out the whole rule or just think about how it's being applied. So if we consider the rules themselves for a moment in terms of what speech these universities allow and prohibit, they tend to closely track the First Amendment. Not necessarily because these universities are held to First Amendment standards, because remember, these are private institutions and not government actors, usually, but because universities have chosen this path. We can talk about why in another episode, but there are a number of good reasons, including providing cover from the kind of fire they find themselves under currently. The rules then treat hate speech as protected speech, unless that speech falls under one of the other well-established exceptions. Now, you can feel any way you want to feel about this. I certainly have my own feelings about hate speech, but these universities didn't just wake up one day and scribble these policies out, and university presidents certainly didn't do it by themselves. They're drawing on well-established principles and teams of lawyers who are very much experts in this area of the law in a way that I am not. And aside from feelings, you can believe if you want to that this is the raw approach, and maybe even think that the Europeans have it right in this regard. But again, you know, you have to think about what the outcome looks like under European law, which we'll get into in our third episode in the series. And whichever way you take, whether you take the U.S. approach or the European approach, context is always central to that inquiry. There's no getting away from it. Now, we can turn back to the question of fair application of the rules. But if the argument is that university presidents should throw out the First Amendment approach to free speech and craft their own versions, we're actually talking about giving them more authority and freedom, not less. So if we're concerned about unequal application now, why would we give them the power to deviate from well-established principles an entire nation has adhered to for decades? It's not really clear when you dig into these arguments what the answer to that question is. And remember that this would be dangerous even if one thought the current presidents were doing a wonderful job and being perfectly fair, because there would always be a risk that the next person could abuse it. So when I hear people suggest that someone they've already accused of being unfair should have more room to be unfair, it's hard to really understand what they're asking for. It's definitely not an argument I could make with a straight face. So I found often in these discussions that the frustration, or in some cases anger, directed at these universities and university leadership isn't really about free speech or anti-Semitism at all, and about something more. So next time, we'll look specifically and more closely at the House hearing on the handling of anti-Semitism at Harvard, the University of Pennsylvania, and MIT. In the meantime, we'll post a transcript of this episode with references on our website. Until next time, I'm Taryn Ward. Thank you for joining us for Breaking the Feed, Social Media Beyond the Headlines.